Hi everyone, welcome back to the Daily Gospel Exegesis podcast, where our goal is to help you understand the scriptures on the literal sense. What did it mean in its original context? That's where we should start as Catholics. So this podcast is about helping you understand the gospel reading from today's Mass. And we do that by going through a verse-by-verse exegesis of the text, which is faithful to the teaching of the Church, but which is rigorous and academic as well. So we're using all the tools we can to really get at the literal sense of the text. Today we have a really deep and rich text. Much has been written about this one over the centuries, and it's one that's well worth meditating on. This particular reading, John chapter 1, verses 1 to 18, it's read quite a few times in the liturgical year, particularly around Christmas time. You'll hear this reading quite a bit. And in fact, it's the reading for the Mass on Christmas Day. That's how important the Church sees this reading. And it really is one where you get new things from it each time that you sit with it. So as we're going through today's reading, I want to really encourage you today to spend time meditating on this text. We're doing quite an academic verse-by-verse approach to breaking down this text, but it really is one where the author and also the Church wants us to sit with it and to really meditate on it. So John chapter 1, verses 1 to 18. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things came to be. Not one thing had its being, but through him. All that came to be had life in him, and that life was the light of men. A light that shines in the dark, a light that darkness could not overpower. A man came sent by God. His name was John. He came as a witness to speak for the light, so that everyone might believe through him. He was not the light, only a witness to speak for the light. The Word was the true light that enlightens all men, and he was coming into the world. He was in the world that had its being through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own domain, and his own people did not accept him. But to all who did accept him, he gave power to become children of God, to all who believe in the name of him who was born not out of human stock, or urge of the flesh, or will of man, but of God himself. The Word was made flesh, he lived among us, and we saw his glory. The glory that is his as the only Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. John appears as his witness. He proclaims, "This is the one of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me, because he existed before me.' Indeed, from his fullness we have all of us received, yes, grace in return for grace. Since, though the law was given through Moses, grace and truth have come through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God. It is the only Son who is nearest to the Father's heart who has made him known." So as you can hear from this text, it's incredibly rich, it's deep, and it's quite philosophical. So in this exegesis today, I'm just going to touch on the meaning of a few key things in each verse. But of course, there's so much more that could be said about it. So it's well worth meditating on this text line by line yourself over an extended period. And if you really want to dive into it, I'd recommend using a written commentary to help you do that. So what we have here today is the prologue to John's Gospel. So we're right at the start of the Gospel of John. And scholars say that this prologue functions kind of like a musical overture. In this prologue, it introduces many of the main themes that the gospel is going to unpack later on. So the prologue, these first 18 verses, mentions light, it mentions life, it mentions darkness, it mentions testimony and witness, it mentions faith, glory, truth. All of these things are mentioned, and these are key themes in the Gospel of John. So let's start at verse 1, the very beginning of the Gospel of John. And the first three words are, "In the beginning." So here, what John is going to do is he's going to trace the origin of the Word, with a capital W, the Word. He's going to show how the Word originated into in eternity past. where God the Son was present with God the Father before time itself began. He says, in the beginning. So he's talking about the very beginning of things. Even before the beginning of the world, the Word was there in eternity with God. Notice that John is deliberately using the same three words that begin the Old Testament, in the beginning. He's doing that deliberately. And also, the themes in John's text here are similar to things that are mentioned in the creation account as well. So we have light and darkness mentioned here. We have the spoken word mentioned as well. So John is immediately drawing his reader's attention to the creation story. By beginning his gospel with the words, in the beginning, his readers would have thought of the creation story, and John is doing that deliberately. But what John is going to do is he's going to highlight the role of the word in creation, and also how that same word, that same logos, is about to bring about a new creation. So he sort of presents his gospel as a second creation. So he says, in the beginning was the word. Now the Greek word here for word is logos. And this is not a word that John invents. It was a word that already had a meaning at the time of that the gospel was written. So his audience would have already had a meaning in mind. But the word meant different things to different groups at this time. So to the Greeks, the word logos meant something like thought or speech that is rational. And the Greeks associated with the order and design of the universe itself. Sometimes they describe the logos as the intelligible expression of the mind of God. That's what the logos is. And we're not entirely sure who John's primary audience is, but it seems likely that he's writing to people who are familiar with Greek philosophy. To the Gentiles at the time, the word logos indicated some form of divine revelation or self-expression. So again, there's this idea of divinity. And to the Jews, the word logos probably was associated with divine wisdom. If you look at the books of wisdom in the Old Testament and Sirach and also the book of Proverbs, they all describe wisdom as having a role in the creation. They almost give wisdom a personality, an identity. And so the Jews at the time of Jesus probably associated logos with that same wisdom creative force that was involved in the creation of the world. So for all of these groups, logos was kind of like the creative force of the universe, which existed before anything else. So John takes all of these ideas and he agrees with them, but he's going to add something new, which is the logos, the word of God, is not an abstract principle. It's actually a divine person who has now come to earth, which is incredibly profound for his audience. The logos is a person and a person who has walked among them. He says, the word was with God. That famous phrase, the word was with God. What that actually is more literally in Greek is the word was towards God. So what John is indicating here is the logos, or the word, is eternal, like God. It exists with God in eternity. So it tells us that the word can be distinguished from God in some sense. The word is with God. It's mentioned separately from the word God. So the word and God are distinguishable in some sense, but he then qualifies it with this phrase, the word was God. So the entire phrase here is, the word was with God and the word was God. This sounds like a contradiction to us. How can you be with God and God at the same time? John is trying to tell his readers that this mystical force, this logos, that people believed in, what is the logos? It's God. It's the God of the Old Testament. God is the logos. Now, there's some very deep Trinitarian philosophy and theology happening here. The Catechism discusses this a lot. It references this passage in a whole lot of places, particularly when the Catechism is discussing Trinitarian theology. Keep in mind that at the time of Jesus, the word God basically referred to what we would today call the Father. And that John kind of keeps that usage as well. So when John uses the word God, he generally means the Father. So what John is sort of getting at here is he's saying that the logos is distinguishable from the Father, what his audience knew as the Father, but that logos is still God. So the teaching here in this phrase is that the logos, the word, and the Father, they have the same nature. They both exist in eternity. They're both God, but they're different people. And that, of course, is what traditional Christian teaching is. there are three persons, one God. And that's exactly what John says here. He says there's two persons existing in eternity, but they're both God. So often you'll hear this claim that Christians sort of invented Trinitarian theology later, and it's not really in the Bible. Although it's true that it's not fully expressed in the Bible, all of the key components are there. And this is one of the key texts. It clearly says that there is at least two people that are eternal, at least two people that are God, and yet they're both God. This is the first and the clearest assertion of the deity of Jesus in the Gospel of John. Here, as we'll see, John basically says the Messiah, Jesus, the Logos, he is God. It's a very clear affirmation that Jesus is God. Now, the Jehovah's Witnesses, you've probably heard this, they don't like this particular phrase because of its implications. They know that this phrase, as we have it in our Bibles, implies that Jesus is God. And Jehovah's Witnesses do not believe that Jesus is God. So their translation of the Bible actually changes this phrase. And what it says is this: in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was a God. So they're actually adding the article a there, which is not in the original. It's not in the Greek. And the vast majority of scholars would say that is not a good translation. That is not what John's saying. He's clearly saying the Word, the Logos, is God. But that's what the Jehovah's Witnesses and other groups have to do in order to get around the implication that Jesus is God, which is what John is clearly saying here in this text. So we're up to verse 2. Verse 2 says, he was in the beginning with God. Notice that the Logos, the Word, is now given a masculine pronoun. He was in the beginning with God. So John here teaches that the Logos was there with God the Father at creation. Verse 3, through him all things came to be. Or you can translate this, all things were made through him. That's quite profound. Often we have this image that God the Father did all the creating and God the Son was kind of just there watching or something. What it says here and what John is teaching is that through him all things came to be. The Son, the Logos, had some sort of role in bringing about creation. The Word is responsible for everything in creation in some sense. And the Word is gendered and personal. Then John says, not one thing had its being but through him. Or you can translate this, without him was not anything made that was made. So here John teaches, as he's inspired by the Holy Spirit, he says that every single thing that exists in creation owes its existence to the Logos. Verse 4, all that came to be had life in him. Another translation of this would be, in him was life. This is a bit hard to understand, this phrase. In him was life. Apparently, it means something like this. The Logos is the source of all life. So that would include natural life and supernatural life. The Logos created natural life in the beginning at creation, and it's the same Logos that gives supernatural life to the children of God in the New Covenant. The Logos is responsible for all life. Then John says, the life was the light of men. Again, this is pretty hard to understand. The theme of light is unpacked a bit later. A reasonable understanding of this phrase would be, it's a reference to the soul of man. The life was the light of men. This is a concept that Greeks and other Gentiles would have thought a lot about and would have been familiar with as well. So John here says that the light which is in men, that's a man's soul, that's the light which is in a man, is ultimately derived from the very life of the Logos himself. The life was the light of men. So the soul which is in a man is ultimately derived from the very life of the Logos himself. This is incredibly profound stuff. And these are key themes that Jesus will unpack more in the Gospel of John. Jesus basically says that humans were created to have divine fellowship with God. And in the New Covenant, Jesus has come to restore that divine fellowship, to be given the very life of the Logos. Verse 5, a light that shines in the dark. So John here says the Logos is the light. It pervades all creation, even through the darkest and most sinful places. In the Gospel of John, darkness basically refers to sin. But here, John says, the Logos shines in the dark. It's a light that darkness cannot overpower. Other translations have this as overcome or comprehend. The darkness cannot comprehend the light, or it can't overpower the light. It might have both meanings here. The idea is that no matter how strong the darkness and sin in the world is, it cannot overpower the Logos. John now changes topics. He starts to talk a bit about John the Baptist. So verse 6, he says, "A man came sent by God. His name was John." So here we have John the Apostle, the author, talking about this figure, John the Baptist. So there's two different Johns involved here. Here the Apostle John, the author, affirms that John the Baptist was sent by God, and he affirms that John the Baptist played a key role in welcoming the Messiah. He's a man sent by God. The author goes on, "He came as a witness to speak for the light." Another translation here would be, "He came for testimony, to bear witness to the light." So John, the author, has just been describing how Jesus is the light of the world, who casts out the darkness. And now he says that John the Baptist's role was to be a witness for the light. He was to point people towards the light. In fact, all of Israel's prophets came to testify to the light. All the prophets of the Old Testament were pointing towards Jesus, the Messiah, ultimately. So John the Baptist continues that role and he fulfills it. So in that sense, John the Baptist is the last and the greatest prophet. And then the author, John, here says, "so that everyone might believe through him." John the Baptist's goal was to help people believe that Jesus is the one sent from God. John the Baptist's ministry was all about pointing people towards Jesus as the Messiah. He came as a witness for the light so that everyone might believe through him. Then the author says something strange here in verse 8. "He was not the light, only a witness to speak for the light." Now, this might seem obvious to us that John the Baptist is not the light, he's not the Messiah, but to many of the Apostle John's authors, that was not obvious. Many people believe that John the Baptist himself was the Messiah. This was actually quite a common view. The Apostle John here, the author, wants to stress to his readers that John the Baptist is not the Messiah. He's merely the prophet preparing people for the Messiah. That actually makes sense because we know from Acts chapter 19 that many of John the Baptist's followers lived in Ephesus, and that appears to be where the Apostle John is writing his gospel from. So many in his audience were probably from Ephesus, and they might have believed that John the Baptist was the Messiah. So the Apostle John is writing to correct that view. Now the author returns to more exalted language. In verse 9, he says, "The word was the true light that enlightens all men." The teaching here is that all human beings are illuminated by the divine light. And that would include our capacity to reason, to know the truth. The word was the true light that enlightens all men. It gives us knowledge of the truth. The Logos makes that possible. St. Thomas Aquinas teaches this. The light of natural reason itself is a participation of the divine light. Our natural ability to know the truth, whereby we discern what is good and what is evil, is nothing else than an imprint on us of the divine light. And that matches very clearly with what we're saying here. The Logos is the very nature and wisdom of God, and he's the one that teaches people the ways of God. Even before he took on human form, the Logos was doing this through creation and through the Old Testament. Now the Logos takes on human flesh. John says in verse 9, "The Logos was coming into the world." So John here is now going to talk about how the Logos, which he's just been describing, which is God, and which has existed before creation, that same Logos is the one which took on flesh in the person of Jesus. Verse 10, "He was in the world that had its being through him." That's quite a profound statement, both philosophically and theology. He was in the world that had its being through him. There's a famous quote about the incarnation which says, "He was crucified on a cross of wood, but he made the hill on which the cross stood." That's well worth reflecting on. This is God himself in human flesh that's coming to the world. So verse 10, "He was in the world that had its being through him, yet the world knew him not." So when the Logos came in the flesh, people in general did not recognize that Jesus was truly God himself. On the whole, people did not acknowledge that. Verse 11, "He came to his own domain and his own people did not accept him." When John here says he came to his own people, that's probably a reference to the Jews. On the whole, the Jews, and particularly the Jewish leadership, they did not accept that Jesus was God. There were some exceptions, of course, but on the whole, the Jewish people rejected Jesus as the Messiah, even though they've been waiting for their Messiah. Verse 12, here's the good news. John says, "But to all who did accept him," or more literally, all who received him, so this would be a reference to Christian believers, he gave power to become children of God. That is the incredible blessing which is available to all Christian believers. We have power to become children of God. By the grace of divine regeneration, Christians are filled with divine life and reborn as sons and daughters of the Father, provided that they continue to have faith and trust in Jesus. And Jesus is going to give us a lot more information about this as the gospel goes on. How is divine life imparted to people? How can they be incorporated into the family of God? And Jesus will say, particularly in chapter 3, that that divine life is primarily imparted through baptism. John says, to all who believe in the name of him. Now, this has been misinterpreted a bit. To believe in the name of someone doesn't just mean to believe that the person existed. In the New Testament, the word name carried the idea of authority of a person. So to believe in the name of Jesus means to believe in the person of Jesus, to fully trust the person of Jesus. So when John here says, to all who did accept him, he gave power to become children of God, to all who believe in his name. It's those who believe that Jesus really is who he says he is, those who submit to his authority. Those are the people who believe in his name, and those are the people who have the power to become children of God. And that's much broader than just believing in Jesus in an intellectual sense. Verse 13, who was born not out of human stock or urge of the flesh or will of man. So John is using a variety of phrases here to describe basically human sexual union. He says that the Logos, even though he took on human flesh, was not born out of a human relation, the flesh of man or the will of man. Rather, he was created directly by God. Quite profound stuff here. Now, some scholars think that these phrases here, when it talks about those who are born not out of human stock or urge of the flesh or will of man, primarily it seems to refer to Jesus in the way that God directly creates him. But some scholars do think maybe it's talking about all Christian believers in general. It's talking about the supernatural birth of Christian believers. When people are born again, they're not born of the will of man, they're born of God directly. Verse 14, John says, the Word was made flesh, or the Logos was made flesh, in the person of Jesus. So Jesus is literally God in human flesh. We need to keep this in mind. He's not just representing God. He's not just a special messenger of God, which is what some other religions teach. Christian teaching, Catholic teaching, is that Jesus is God in human flesh. It's a mystery, but it has been revealed to us, at least partially, the mystery of the incarnation. John says he lived among us and we have seen his glory. So the Apostle John is emphasizing that this Logos has walked among them. They have seen them. The Apostle John himself has seen the Logos walking around in the person of Jesus. So when he says he lived among us and we have seen his glory, he's speaking to his audience. Probably some of his readers were eyewitnesses to Jesus. They have seen him walking the earth. John is reminding them, we have seen the Logos. He made his dwelling amongst us. A more literal translation there would be, he tabernacled among us. The language of tabernacling is referring to primarily to the way God dwelt among his people in the Old Testament, particularly in the tabernacle. Remember, in the early days of Israel, they used to carry the tabernacle around the desert, and then later in the temple, God tabernacled among the people there. He dwelt in their midst. Well, now God is dwelling in the midst of his people in a new way. He's tabernacling among them by taking on human flesh. Jesus is literally God among his people. In fact, many Old Testament prophecies talk about a future temple that will be established in connection with the final kingdom of God. If you look at Ezekiel 37 and Ezekiel 48, they both talk about that one day God will set up a new temple in his new covenant. That temple is Jesus. And he uses the word the glory here. Now, in the Old Testament, the glory of God is basically the magnificence of God's presence, which is visible in the fiery cloud that indwelt the wilderness tabernacle. So he's just been talking about tabernacles, and now he mentions the word glory. So primarily, he's thinking of the glory that was associated with the tabernacle. If you look at Exodus chapter 40, it talks about God's physical glory that could be seen. Well, that same glory, the Shekinah glory of God, it now dwells in Jesus. And this is what Jesus is constantly trying to get across, particularly to the Jewish leaders. He's saying, the glory of God dwells in me. But it's also kind of veiled in a sense. And this is why people often don't understand in the Gospel of John. The glory of God is fully present in Jesus, but it's veiled. It only kind of partially reveals itself through the miracles. And that's what's so important about the miracles in the Gospel of John. They're pointers towards Jesus' true identity. So the full phrase here that John uses is he has the glory that is his as the only Son of the Father. So Jesus, the Logos, has a special glory that only he can possess because he is the only Son of the Father. He shares the same nature as the Father, so he has a special kind of glory. Now, in New Testament times, the word son carried a lot of meaning. It meant more than it does today. A son basically meant the very image of the Father. A son was considered to be a perfect representative or the best representative of a father. So to speak of the Son of God basically means to say that there's a being who fully represents God perfectly. He's a being that has the same nature as God. When we hear the phrase Son of God, we kind of just think of it as like a special creation of God. But it seems that in New Testament times, they would have understood it to mean more than that. It would be the perfect representative of the Father, the very image of the Father, in fact. And John here says he is full of grace and truth. Jesus has come to reveal what God's will is to the world. He's come to bring truth to the world and grace. Verse 15, John the Apostle now once again talks about John the Baptist. He says, John appears as his witness, or you can translate that, John bore witness to him. What's John the Baptist's role? It's to point people towards the Messiah. And then the Apostle John says that John the Baptist in his ministry said this about Jesus. This is the one of whom I said, he who comes after me ranks before me because he existed before me. So John the Baptist says, the one who comes after me ranks before me because he existed before me. So John the Baptist perceived that Jesus is God. He perceives that Jesus is pre-existent. So it looks like the Apostle John, the author, is again emphasizing to his readers that John the Baptist is not the Messiah. And in fact, John the Baptist himself knew that. That's why the Apostle John quotes John the Baptist here. The Apostle John wants to convince his readers that even John the Baptist admitted himself that he's not the Messiah. Rather, Jesus is the Messiah. Verse 16, indeed, from his fullness we have all of us received. So he's talking here about his audience, all Christian believers that John is writing to. We have all received from his fullness grace in return for grace. Or you can translate this phrase grace upon grace, or even grace in place of grace, which is interesting. So John here is talking about two different kinds of grace, one which builds on the other, grace upon grace. What are the two kinds of graces that John has in mind here? He tells us in verse 17, he says, the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. John here is not saying that the law given through Moses is bad. What he's saying is that God has given two different types of grace in salvation history, and the second kind builds on the first kind. The first kind is the law given through Moses. That gave a partial indication of God's will. Jesus, the fullest revelation of God, is the final revelation of God. It's the fullest revelation of God's will. So the law was a kind of grace, but then Jesus is the final revelation of grace, which builds on the law. John's point appears to be that the final and perfect form of God's revelation has now appeared. So he's saying good is followed by better. The law was good, but Jesus Christ as the fullest revelation of God is even better. Verse 18, the last verse here, John says, no one has ever seen God. Now, what does this mean? It apparently means something like this. No one has ever perceived God's true nature. There have been times in the Old Testament where people have kind of seen an image of God or some sort of representation of God, but it's certainly true that no one has ever perceived God's true nature. Humans are not capable of that until eternity. But then the Apostle John follows it up with this. It is the only Son who is nearest to the Father's heart, or you can translate this, who is in the bosom of the Father. So the point here is the Son, the Logos, is uniquely qualified to know God's true nature because he exists in the bosom of the Father. He's the one who does know God's true nature. Now, we need to stop at this point because there's some textual variance here. Our lectionary translation just says, it is the only Son who is nearest to the Father's heart. A lot of other Bibles have this as the only begotten Son. Now, that phrase begotten can mean a few different things. It can refer to the eternal generation of Christ within the Trinity, as in the Father is eternally begetting the Son, and that's certainly the way the Creed takes it, and that's where most of the Catechism paragraphs focus on this, as the Father begets the Son, because some Bible translations do put this as the only begotten Son. But there's another meaning of begotten as well, which can mean it's a unique or precious Son. And sometimes in the Old Testament, particularly Abraham, when he has Isaac, refers to Isaac as his only begotten son, even though he actually does have other sons. So that word, those words only begotten, get a lot of discussion amongst theologians. Now let's take it a step further. Sometimes it's actually worth diving into different translations of the text because they can reveal things that are not always obvious in our lectionary translation. There's actually some manuscripts which put it this way. They say this, God the only begotten son. That's the actual phrase it uses, God the only begotten son. And it's not just one manuscript, there's several ancient manuscripts which put it this way. There's not many modern Bibles which translate it that way because we're not sure if this is the original manuscript, but there's a significant number of manuscripts which actually have this phrase as God the only begotten son who is nearest to the Father's heart. If that's the original, that directly asserts the divinity of Jesus. It literally says the only begotten son is God. And so it's worth pointing that out, that that is a possible translation. So John here says, it is the only son who is nearest to the Father's heart who has made him known. So this is the mission of the Son, the Logos. He has come to make known the true nature and the will of the Father. That's the whole point of Jesus being sent to earth. In fact, people can now literally see and touch God in the person of Jesus. Later in the Gospel of John, Jesus himself says, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. That's in chapter 14, verse 9. That's how true it is that Jesus really is God. Whoever has seen me has seen the Father. So that's the end of our verse-by-verse exegesis of this text today. As you can see, it's an incredibly rich text. There's so much that could be said about it. Hopefully what I've said today gives you at least a starting point and some things to think about. You can hear the next section of text of John chapter 1 on January 2nd every year. So you might like to look through the podcast archives to find that next section of text on January 2nd. Let's turn to the Catechism. As you would expect, the Catechism of the Catholic Church has heaps and heaps of references to John chapter 1. This prologue is an incredibly profound theological text, and it informs a lot of Catholic theology. There's a whole number of beautiful paragraphs in the Catechism about the Trinity, which are based on this text, and I wish I could read them all out, but there's about 20 or 30 of them. So I'm just going to pick a few highlights, and I'll include as many of these as I can in the show notes. So if you look at the episode description on whatever device you're listening on, you should be able to see a whole list of Catechism paragraphs which talk about John chapter 1 and help us understand what Catholic teaching is. So let's have a look at paragraph 454. This is about the only Son of God. It says, the title Son of God signifies the unique and eternal relationship of Jesus Christ to God his Father. He is the only Son of the Father. He is God himself. To be a Christian, one must believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. So that there is a nice summary of Catholic teaching on the Trinity, largely based on John chapter 1. Paragraph 2780 is about the word Father. It says, we can invoke God as Father because he is revealed to us by his Son, becoming man, and because his Spirit makes him known to us. The personal relation of the Son to the Father is something that man cannot conceive of, nor the angelic powers even dimly see. And yet the Spirit of the Son grants us a participation in that very relation to us who believe that Jesus is the Christ and that we are born of God. Paragraph 1216, this is about the sacrament of baptism. The sacrament of baptism is called enlightenment because those who receive this catechetical instruction are enlightened in their understanding. Having received in baptism the word, the true light that enlightens every man, the person baptized has been enlightened. He becomes a son of light. Indeed, he becomes light himself. We often don't talk about this in contemporary Catholic theology, but it is the understanding of the Church that when a person is baptized, they receive light in a new way. And here, the Catechism links that to John chapter 1, as Jesus is the light, the true light that enlightens every man. And when a person is baptized, they receive that light in a fuller way. Paragraph 1996, this is about grace. It says, our justification comes from the grace of God. Grace is favor, the free and undeserved help that God gives us to respond to his call to become children of God, adoptive sons, partakers of the divine nature and of eternal life. So there we hear that language of sonship being called into God's family. Paragraph 423 is about the good news. We believe and confess that Jesus of Nazareth, born of a Jew, of a daughter of Israel at Bethlehem at the time of King Herod the Great and the Emperor Caesar Augustus, a carpenter by trade, who died crucified in Jerusalem under the procurator Pontius Pilate during the reign of the Emperor Tiberius, is the eternal Son of God made man. He came from God, descended from heaven, and came in the flesh. For the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth. We have beheld his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father. And from his fullness have we all received grace upon grace. So in all these foundational parts of the Catechism, we see John chapter 1 being referenced. It's a really key text in our understanding of the Trinity and of salvation. Let's finish today with paragraph 151. For a Christian, believing in God cannot be separated from believing in the one he sent, his beloved Son, in whom the Father is well pleased. God tells us to listen to him. The Lord himself said to his disciples, believe in God, believe also in me. We can believe in Jesus Christ because he is himself God, the Word made flesh. No one has ever seen God, the only Son, who is in the bosom of the Father, he has made him known. Because he has seen the Father, Jesus Christ is the only one who knows him and can reveal him. So it's been a longer episode today, but I hope you can see that it's well worth it given how important this text is in the Church's liturgy and theology. If you've enjoyed today's episode, if you think there's others in your life who would benefit from hearing a verse-by-verse exegesis from a Catholic perspective, like this podcast offers, please share this podcast around, tell other people about it, and subscribe on whatever you're listening on, leave a review. It really does make a difference for the ministry. Thanks, and hopefully you'll tune in again tomorrow.